And now we talk about sci-fi. Mark Zakrie with us, and we're going to jump right into it when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to have a couple hours of some fun. Mark Zakrie is a science fiction author, television writer, screenwriter, movie producer. Mark has been nominated for several of the industry awards. And, of course, you know him when we talk about his work, The Twilight Zone Companion and his DVD series. And here he is back on Coast to Coast, Mark Zakrie. Hey, always a pleasure, Mark.
It's great to be here, George. I always love talking with you.
How are your movies coming along?
They're great. They're great. I have my own studio now. I'm shooting Space Command. I was spending all day editing the second Space Command story. We were just sitting looking at a big screen and choosing the different takes today.
I remember when you bought the set some time ago, so you're really up and running big time now.
Yeah, we are. We basically shot the first two-hour story at 30 minutes of the second two-hour story, and now we're pitching it to the networks. I've been having meetings in England and here. It's going very well. I'm rep by CAA now, which is a big agency, and so we're pitching it, and what the network that picks it up has to pick up an entire season. So it's a very different world from how it used to be when I started in TV many years ago.
Do you like it? You having fun?
Oh, my God, yes. The fun part is I'm working with a lot of stars that I've worked with on different TV shows. So I reached out to all of my friends from these different shows, and they all said yes. So it's a dream come true.
What is new with you other than that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I just wrote the new edition of The Twilight Zone Companion, and
the
e-book has just come out. And the fun part with e-books is you can have links to audio and video. There's hundreds of new photos, over 100 pages of new material. I'm also writing a book about my friendship with Ray Bradbury. You and I knew Ray. And there's just, I'm working on tons of stuff. We're also doing a couple of features in England as well. So it's been an amazing time. The fun part is that your LinkedIn, as you know, with Coast to Coast, your LinkedIn is the entire world. Your audience is your collaborator. It's a two-way conversation. I just love it.
And you know, you concentrate a lot on Ray Bradbury and his role in your companion.
Yes. Well, Ray was an amazing friend and mentor. I'd go over to his house once a month for over a decade. And, you know, he was the big inspiration to Rod Serling. He mentored all of the great writers from Twilight Zone. Just a one-of-a-kind person, an amazing, amazingly talented man.
I still have the personal letter he sent me up on my bulletin board, and it will stay there until I go.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing.
Well, he was really one of the first of the modern writer in the way that he was writing TV and films and, of course, books. And he was multimedia way before that was even a term.
What is it about sci-fi, Mark, that people just love? Wait till we open up the phone calls and the phone lines next hour and talk about, you know, your favorite sci-fi shows and things. But what is it about that? People just love it.
Well, you know, it's so imaginative, and it puts you into the future. It puts you into possibility. You know, if there's something that you're excited about regarding the future, you can really create that future world. But also, if there's something in the world that you're concerned about or upset about, like, for instance, Rod Serling, you know, when he was writing about prejudice or the issues of the day, or Gene Roddenberry with Star Trek, you know, you can really take almost any issue and put it into a science fiction context, and it's no longer specific to the day. So people, whatever their walk of life, whatever their political persuasion, they can watch a story and really look at an issue fresh. And I think it's a great storytelling medium. I love working in science fiction.
Rod Serling, is there another mind like his out there?
No, he was one of a kind. I mean, when you realize that he created Twilight Zone, and over 5 years, he did 152 episodes. He wrote 92 of them himself, and every episode was a different story, a set of characters. It wasn't like doing, you know, a show like Breaking Bad, where every week it's the same characters. He had to build the infrastructure every single week over and over and over again.
It was a new show every week.
It was. And he was the star of it. I mean, he was also the first writer who was also the star of his own show, the producer of his own show. There's a phrase we use in television nowadays called a showrunner. And, you know, Vince Gilligan with Breaking Bad, or, you know, all these different guys, J.J. Abrams, Damon Lindelof with Lost.
Wasn't Rockne O'Banion? He was going to be a showrunner.
Yes, our dear friend who created Farscape and Defiance, yes. But Rod was really the first modern showrunner where he said, I have an idea for a show, and I'm going to run it. Prior to that, it was the producers, not the writers, who ran television. But Rod was really the first of the modern showrunner.
Was he supposed to be the talent in the show originally?
No, the funny part was, when they shot the pilot, they used a guy named Westbrook von Voorhees to narrate it. He had been the big voice from March of Time, you know, these big newsreels they used to do, and he had this kind of big booming voice, totally wrong for Twilight Zone. And then they tried to get Orson Welles, and he wanted too much money. And finally, they were sort of out of options, and Rod said, well, how about me? And everyone else just kind of fell out of their chair laughing. And then they tried it, and of course, he was perfect.
He was perfect. I remember he come out with that cigarette and do his thing. And, and unfortunately, it was that cigarette that was his untimely death, wasn't it?
Yes. It led to the heart problems that ultimately led to his death, yes, sadly.
I always remember the story you were telling us. You were rummaging upstairs in his attic and came across some old Twilight Zone scripts.
Yeah, I felt like I was the guy who discovered King Tut's tomb or something. Rod, when I started writing the Twilight Zone Companion, it was only a couple of years after Rod's death, and so his house was exactly as he left it, with all the books, all the awards, the 6 Emmys were there, and the Peabody Award, and all of that. And up in his attic, he kept his scrapbooks, and there were clippings from everything he'd ever done, and there was a box. And I opened the box, and it was filled with Twilight Zone scripts that were written but never produced. And there were scripts by Serling and 2 by Ray Bradbury, and there was even one by Arch Obler, who wrote Lights Out on radio. And these were amazing scripts. There was a great one by Richard Matheson and one by Charles Beaumont, great writers of the Twilight Zone. And it was just a treasure trove. It was phenomenal.
Now, Mark, we may have some younger people listening to you right now, and they're saying, what are they talking about? What's the Twilight Zone?
Yes.
What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them Twilight Zone is probably, very possibly, the greatest TV show ever made. And it was it debuted in 1959. It ran through 1964. It was 4 seasons were half-hour episodes. 1 season, the 4th season, was hour episodes, 18-hour-long episodes. It starred the greatest actors, the greatest writers, the greatest directors, the greatest composers. Bernard Herrmann, who did Citizen Kane and Psycho, composed for Twilight Zone. And if you've never seen it, boy, have you missed out. But thankfully, you can watch it on Netflix, on Amazon. It's everywhere. And they have, of course, the marathons on the holidays. And it doesn't date. It's about regular people having amazing, strange things happen to them. There's really nothing like it. It's really unique.
Sadly, when Rod died at the age of 50, he did not think he was a success.
No. You know, the last interview he ever gave, the interviewer said, do you think your work will last? And he said, good writing, like good wine, has to age well with time. He said, my work has been momentarily adequate.
So wow.
It's, terrible, huh?
Would he say today with all the hoopla about his work?
If he were around now, he'd be 91 years old, and he'd know that he had changed the face of television, he'd changed the face of America, that there, you know, his work is immortal. I mean, it's when I started writing The Twilight Zone Companion, when I was in my early 20s, I was 22 when I started writing that book, I had no idea myself that it would still be more popular than ever now. And so I'm very pleased, and Rod would be very pleased too, and amazed.
A few months ago, I was at AlienCon, which is a convention dealing with aliens, and had a great time. And guess who's there?
Who?
Your buddy.
Wow.
Billy Mumy.
Of course.
There he was. He's going, George! And there he was up there. He was in 3 Twilight Zones, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And they're all 3 terrific episodes, In Praise of Pip, and It's a Good Life, where he wishes people the cornfield.
I love that one. That one I'll always remember. You're a bad man.
That's right. And Long Distance Call, which is about a toy telephone where his dead grandmother is calling him and luring him to death. And that one, there were only 6 Twilight Zone episodes that were shot on black and white videotape, and that's one of those episodes. The others were shot, of course, on 35mm film. And it's funny because, of course, I've known Bill Mumy since I was 7, and we worked together on Babylon 5, and I interviewed him when I wrote The Twilight Zone Companion, and now we've been shooting Space Command together, so he's one of our leads. So it's so wonderful to make friends who stay as working companions and friends throughout your lifetime.
That is so cool. Did he have fun doing Space Command?
Oh, my God, yes. And he brought Bruce Boxleitner to play a role on Space Command. They'd worked together on Babylon 5. And Mira Furlan, who also worked with Bill on Babylon 5, it was sort of a reunion for the 3 of them. They hadn't worked together since that show, and then they came together on Space Command. So it was just terrific.
Do you rely a lot on computer graphics, Mark?
Yes, we do. And we have, for instance, in the first 2 two-hour episode, we have 1,900 visual effects shots, which is
Wow.
a huge crazy amount, and that's more than Star Wars. And so we're working with visual effects artists both here and in New York and in Germany, people all over the world. And thank God it's a, as I said, a world community where we can all work together.
Without a computer, how much would it cost you to do the same kind of effects that
Oh,
you would probably have to build out?
it would be millions and millions of dollars. It would be just, actually, it would be impossible without computers.
Isn't that amazing how technology has changed? And even over the last couple of years, it keeps changing,
I
doesn't
know.
it?
It's phenomenal. I mean, when I started in television, as I said, we shot 35 millimeter or 16 millimeter film. We'd be editing on what was called a moviola. It was very laborious, very expensive. Now you can shoot with digital cameras. I own a Red camera, which is a very high-end camera. We edit on a Mac. Today, for instance, my editor came over to my house. He ran a cable from his computer to my big screen TV, and we sat on my sofa and edited. So it was me. It was me and Elaine and my editor and my dog, and we just sat and worked all day, and that's the life, I'll tell you, but totally different from when I started out.
You have, of course, developed a YouTube channel too called Mr. Sci-Fi.
That's right. Well, I was having lunch a couple of years ago with my friend Glenn Mazera, who was the showrunner on The Walking Dead and executive producer on The Shield, and he said, "You know so much about science fiction, you should have your own channel." So I basically every week or so I'll shoot a little video and I'll talk about science fiction books and TV shows and movies and whatever interests me. And I've been doing this for a couple of years now, and we have, thousands of subscribers. And it's very easy and very fun. I just use my iPhone. So it's funny because Space Command is this enormous, epic project on a huge scale. But Mr. Sci-Fi is just, I grab my iPhone, I say what's on the top, the top of my head, what I want to talk about.
It's like a video blog.
It is very much so. It's a diary. But of course, because I'm so plugged into the world of science fiction, because I know so many people creating the great TV shows and movies now and writing the great books, I'm often talking about things that they've told me, but the general public doesn't know about these things. So it's great to be able to share sort of the insider secrets.
Growing up as a kid, what was your favorite sci-fi show?
Oh, wow. Well, Star Trek and Twilight Zone and Outer Limits are the three shows that made me want to be a writer. And when I was a kid, I got a Christmas present of a trip to the Star Trek set. And I was on the set for the last episode of Star Trek, the original show ever shot. It was called Turnabout Intruder. And that I got to sit in the captain's chair. I stood on the transporter. It was a dream come true. And when I stand on my Space Command sets, because again, I have literally a studio, it's exactly that same feeling. Just there I am on my spaceship. I mean, I'm 8 years old again.
That's exciting. It really is. I used to like One Step Beyond.
Yes.
Science Fiction Theater was one of my first shows that my dad used to sit me down. He used to watch it religiously. And I remember they had shows on UFOs and all kinds of things.
That's right. And the fun part is that it would really open up your mind because, you'd watch these shows about aliens or about going into another dimension, and all of a sudden you realize that reality was very different from what you thought it was, and much larger and much more beguiling and romantic in a certain way. And so television really was, for many people, it really opened a door in their mind. And I think the counterculture that you had in the 60s wouldn't really have come into existence in the way it did if not for shows like Twilight Zone and One Step Beyond that said, there are different alternatives.
Of everything that you've touched so far, Mark, in your career, what has been for you the most fulfilling?
I
That's a
think my
loaded question, I know.
yeah no I mean, as you know, George, I've done hundreds of hours of network TV. I've worked for all the major studios and networks, and that's been very gratifying. It's great when you have a dream and you realize it. And one day, two studios were shooting my work simultaneously when I was a producer on Sliders, and Deep Space Nine was also shooting one of my episodes, and that was wonderful. But I'd have to say that the most gratifying time for me is now,
Good for you.
because the fact that I was able to reach out to my audience, and they sent me money and financed me, and I was able to open my own studio, and I was able to shoot Space Command exactly.
Our audience helped you, I
Yes, they
think.
did. Yes, they did. Greatly. And the fact that I could shoot Space Command exactly the way I wanted, with no censorship, no one saying, and I could cast whoever I wanted, literally. When I cast Doug Jones, Doug Jones is going to star in the new Star Trek TV show. He played Pan in Pan's Labyrinth. He was in Falling Skies as the lead alien. Well, I just called Doug and said, "You want to be in Space Command?" He said, "Sure." Whereas I didn't have to go to a network and say, "Well, how about Doug Jones or Mira Furlan or Bill Mumy?" I didn't need anyone's permission, and that's so liberating. And I wanted to create a hopeful vision of the future, just like Star Trek inspired me. I wanted to create something that would inspire people now and say there are challenges in the future, but we can come together, we can reach across barriers of ethnicity and race and religion and create a better future. And I was able to shoot that and create it thanks to the audience believing in me. And I just love that. I wouldn't want to be in any other part of my life.
I am sure the many channels that are out there now have created just an incredible need for programming.
Yes.
To the point where it's just truly remarkable for a producer.
Yes.
You know, in the old days when we just had the three television networks, there, you know, it was very tight and you didn't have a lot of competition out there. But now you've got a zillion channels, Mark, and everything out there needs programming, doesn't
it? That's right. Well, amazingly, there are close to 500 scripted comedy and drama series on all the different networks and platforms. And it's just phenomenal. And the kinds of shows you're getting, the quality of many of them is quite high. And it's fascinating because I'm meeting with many of these executives now, and they're very open to new ideas and fresh ideas. And I really like it. I think it's, again, I much prefer the way things are being done now than back when you had three networks. In fact, there was a script when they brought Twilight Zone back as a TV show in the late 80s. I actually sold an episode to them. And it was a week away from shooting, and the censors pulled the plug because they felt it was too hard-edged. And now you wouldn't even bat an eye. And it was it had a very moral and very compassionate message. But the CBS censors felt back then it would be so timid now. And now again, I don't need permission from anyone. So that's really lovely. I much prefer the way TV is done now to the way it was done back then. And back then, of course, Rod Serling created Twilight Zone because he needed to get past the censors to comment on
social issues.
Yes, and he understood that science fiction would allow him to slip it by the censors, and that worked. But he was very frustrated until that point because he couldn't write about politics or race or religion or anything. And Twilight Zone was his escape hatch.
Are they paying for the programs these days, or has that gone down?
No, they're paying for them, but there's sort of two tiers. So for instance, someone doing their own web series might not be making any money at all, but if you're doing it for a major network or a big platform like Netflix or Amazon, they're paying well. The money is still very good.
Amazon has really done a great job.
Yes.
And so has Netflix.
Yeah, well, my friend Frank Spotnitz created Man in the High Castle, which is a great show, and I'm a huge nut for alternate histories where the Nazis won. It's a very fun storyline to examine. When we were on Sliders, we were often talking about that arena, and so Frank has become a good friend and mentor, and again, that's a great show, and it's based on a novel by Philip K. Dick that was written in 1963. So they're looking for shows from every direction, old novels, you know, old movies, you name it, and originals as well.
So I assume for the executives in Hollywood, it's opened up some careers too.
Yes, it has. And also, you know, I've been talking to a lot of my friends who run network shows, and we're even talking about creating a showrunner network, and where it would be showrunner driven. And it would be sort of like, what shows haven't you had a chance to make? What shows do the networks not let you create? And starting to see ways of directly reaching out to the audience and making those shows. And I think that's a great possibility. And you know, I have to get Space Command out of the way and you know, make that show first. But that's sort of the next idea coming down the pike. And I'm getting a very great response from my friends that I'm starting to talk to about this.
Mark, as you look at upcoming different kinds of genre that's out there, a lot is in the reality business these days. A lot of programs are being geared to really younger people, more horror and slashing. Is that going to change at all?
Well, you know, I think there's always, you know, I have great hope for young people because I think that, you know, some shows and some movies can sort of go to the lowest common denominator, the most violent, the most, you know, reprehensible. But people want to be inspired. And people want to be moved and entertained and be shown a greater possibility. And I think that cuts across all barriers of age, race, everything. I find great people wherever I go. And many of my friends are in their 20s. And I run a roundtable here in L.A. of writers and directors and actors and producers. It's several thousand people. We have offshoots all over the country. And it's open to everyone who has a good heart. And the youngest member is, you know, 12 years old. She started at 8. Her grandmother brought her. And the oldest member's in his 80s. And everyone's treated equally. And we all come together as a family.
All right. We're coming back with more with Mark Zucree. And then we're going to open up the phone lines later. to talk about some of your favorite weird sci-fi stuff. And welcome back to Coast, Mark Zakri with us, of course, and we're talking about his work. We're also talking about the world of sci-fi. We'll take your calls next hour. You can jump in. Mark, I was looking at one of your trailers for Space Command that you unveiled at Comic-Con back a few years ago. Is Billy's hair? I don't remember it being that long. When I just ran into him, I think he cut it again.
Yeah, it was long, and we actually have him play two different ages because he creates this race of artificial human synthetics, and so we show him when he's younger, unveiling them, and then older throughout the course of the adventure. And so his hair was long when we shot, and we're going to be bringing him back as a character later in Space Command because, you know, I've written the first 8 hours of it and outlined hours 9 through 12, so that's the season, and then it continues beyond that. And but he was so much fun to work with. I mean, he's such a pro. You know, he's been acting since he was a little kid.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, and so to have him on set and his suggestions are terrific. I mean, I tend to be very collaborative. I love working with actors and editors and, you know, everyone in the process. And I'm never offended by someone having an idea. As you know, I always welcome people to say, well, here's another way we might do it, or here's something that could add to this. And I'll say yes or no. Everyone knows that as the director and the writer and producer, I'm the boss. But I make it very creatively open in that way, where because I want everyone to feel free to bring their best work.
How long does it take to do some of those computer graphics? The scene that I was looking at was you looked like you were in an asteroid belt, for example.
Yes. Well, you know, you hire very, very talented visual effects artists.
Who work on movies.
That's right, yes, movies and TV shows. So we've been working with the top people in the industry, artists who worked on Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars, and, you know, and all the top shows. And then they'll come to us because they love doing Space Command, they love doing the story, they love what it stands for. But it takes many months. And for instance, I'm now there's an effects team that did our trailer, and they're going to be generating the first 35 minutes of the 2-hour story work from stem to stern, and that'll take the next 3 months to do that. And so once the show gets picked up by a network, then you have millions of dollars, and you can hire. You know, then it's a much faster.
Then it's different.
Time period. Yeah, it's different. When I'm on a TV show, they'll be turning things around in a matter of weeks or a month or two at most.
If it's picked up by a network, and obviously then, you know, the bigger dollars start to flow to the company. Do you change your techniques at all, or do you have to buy bigger things, or can you just stay the way you are?
It's a very interesting question, George, and it depends on who buys it, because obviously we'd hire many, many more people, because the number of people that I'm hiring at any given point depends on whether I'm shooting, in which case it may be 80 or 100 people, or when I'm in post-production where it only may be a very small team. But, for instance, if Netflix picks up the show, if I'm able to keep my studio here in Los Angeles and shoot in L.A., which I'd like to do, one of my friends just came aboard the California Film Commission, and they very much want to keep production here.
Well, they need to. They need to.
Yes, and so if we stay in L.A., then, you know, I'll have millions of dollars. I'll be hiring hundreds and hundreds of people. And so that would be perfect, you know, that'd be ideal. But again, the fact that I'm not under a studio's umbrella means that I can shoot for a lot less. My overhead is lower, thank God. And so that's why I've been able to do Space Command, where it looks as good as any network show, but much less expensive to make.
The people who have seen this on the network level,
mm-hmm.
are they amazed by it, by the look?
Yes. Well, when I showed the opening 5 minutes, which is completed with all the visual effects.
And that's all they need to see, right?
The network executives and my friends who run network shows, they are impressed and they are amazed but very encouraging. That's the great part. I met with the BBC in England and many of the English executives because of my friend Frank Spotnitz, because he's based now in England and he lives in Paris. The guy who created Man in the High Castle, he's running 4 series right now. Comes off X-Files, the thing I didn't know until I started pitching the show was when I said, well, you know, 3,000 people around the world gave me $700,000, I didn't know if that would make it sound like some kind of fan thing or not professional. Absolutely the opposite.
They love that, didn't they?
That's right, because the fact that my audience is willing to put down money and millions of people around the world know about Space Command means that I have an audience already, and they're really very, very avid. And that makes it even more appealing for them to pick up the show. So that was great to learn.
When somebody, you know, donates money through a Kickstarter campaign, you as the producer, director, what do they get back? I mean, what do they want?
Well, it's a very interesting question because our initial campaign, we raised $200,000, a little more than that, and that was Kickstarter. And they get a copy of the film. They might get T-shirts or posters or whatever. But then I was able to sell investment shares, and those people actually will get a share. They'll get part of the profits that come from the first four hours that we've written and we've been shooting. Those would be the first four episodes, and they would get a percentage of my profits. And so they can stand to make a lot of money. And that's what they hope for. It's regular people from around the world, truck drivers and just regular Joes. It's not expensive for them to invest. And I deliberately did it that way because I don't want it to be millionaires and billionaires and captains of industry or corporate heads. I want it to be people like me and you know, fans and regular people who can invest in a dream. And I don't mean invest financially. I mean invest emotionally.
And time.
Yes. And I mean, even someone sends me an email and says, I love what you're doing. Keep going. I love what you stand for. I get those emails almost every day. And that's every bit as important to me as someone who sends money, because because we're all part of the same dream and the same heart. And that's really what gets me out of bed in the morning.
Have you been approached by someone who wants to buy you up?
Yes, it's interesting. We started getting a lot of feature companies, a lot of independent feature companies wanted to buy Space Command even early on, but I didn't want to do that because it would then be, it might be in Redbox or whatever. No one would know it existed. I wanted to be on a network. And by network, I mean Netflix would be fine, Amazon, Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But by shooting it first, shooting this much of it, then they know what they're buying into, and so they're not going to give me stupid notes or insist I put actors in it who can't act, or the things that ruin a show. That's why I really put my money where my mouth was and put in all this time and effort.
What is happening in terms of the formats these days, Mark, in terms of the types of shows, the demographics, who are they going after, male, female? I mean, I would think primarily men would like to watch sci-fi, but is that changing?
Well, it is, and women. A large part of our fan base is women as well, and people all across the world. I mean, the fun part is, I have characters in Space Command who are Muslim, but I think Muslims are often badly presented in American media. They're demonized, or they're sort of like the hero's best friend. And I wanted it to just be Robert Picardo from Star Trek Voyager plays a character named Yusuf Sikander. He's Muslim, but just like I'm Jewish, or I might have friends who are Catholic, it's an aspect of spirituality. But he's raising his son. His wife died. He's a regular working guy. And I wanted to present that. And so I got a call from a young woman in Kuwait, and she wanted to invest in Space Command because she felt that was presenting, the world accurately.
Well, I got to tell you, I know a lot of people who are of the Muslim faith. I had a doctor friend of mine back in St. Louis who saved my life a long time ago. And I mean, these people are wonderful people. And,
yes.
And the problem is with these billions of wonderful people, it's offset by the thousands of sick fanatics,
yes,
who are doing what they're doing right now. And
yes,
that taints the whole thing.
But we all know that fanaticism cuts across every stripe and every walk of life. And I think that really, if I divide the world into people who are compassionate and people who aren't, and I it's funny because when during the break I was listening to that statement you made of having guests on the show from all different political stripes,
mm-hmm,
and not being argumentative with them, because when you're open to everyone's viewpoint, then you can reach across those barriers and you make a better world because you come from a compassionate heart and an intellectual curiosity. And I think that's vital. And so I don't want to close the world out. I think we all want to be safe. No one wants someone to blow them up or hurt their kids or any of that. We all want security and safety. But I think it's very important not to demonize people and to really see that hatred and, as you said, fanaticism and violence are the enemies and injustice is the enemy. And I think that we all have to strive to have a world where people are safe, where they can take care of their kids, where they're where they recognize that people who have different ideas from you are not the enemy. People who dress differently I'm inclusive. That's just, and Star Trek and Twilight Zone, those are shows that taught us to be inclusive and to see through other people's eyes. I think it's vital.
Do you remember the old types of TV shows and things where if you saw a spaceship, you could see the string holding it up?
Yes, but it's funny because Star Trek was really the cutting edge of science fiction visual effects of that time, and 2001, of course. And when I look at those effects, when you really know how cutting edge those were at the time. I find them still exciting and wonderfully done. And I know many of those visual effects guys from that era. And a friend of mine built the city in Blade Runner, and I'm a huge fan of Blade Runner. I said to him, because he's been giving me a lot of material to reuse for the he built for various movies, and I said to him, if you have anything from Blade Runner, I would love it. So he actually gave me part of the city from Blade Runner, which is now part of my collection.
Here's one I almost forgot from way gone back. Supercar. Remember that one?
Yes, I loved Supercar. It was on when I was a kid. And funnily enough, the producer of that show, Jerry Anderson, I later wrote for him. He did a TV show called Space Precinct, and I wrote about, I think, four of those.
Clutch Cargo.
Yes, that had the real mouths with the animated characters. It was creepy but fun. It was another show that I loved.
Who would come up with that kind of a concept?
Someone extremely warped.
I wonder if they went on to other things.
Yes, they actually did a show called Space Angel that was science fiction, but it had that same thing with real human mouths with animation. It was, again, equally peculiar.
Yeah, if I remember Clutch Cargo, the little boy was Spinner. The dog was called Paddlefoot.
Wow.
Remember that?
Yeah, but the great thing is that we can still watch those things. I mean, now we live in this age where almost anything from any era, you just type it in YouTube or you go on to Netflix or Amazon, and there it is.
Not a lot of animation. Most of it were stills,
right?
If
exactly.
I remember, other than
exactly.
The moving lips.
Yeah, and it's funny because years later when I broke into television when I was 22, 23 years old, I started in animation. So I was writing for Smurfs and He-Man and Super Friends and Real Ghostbusters, and even those shows didn't have full animation. So there's been an evolution of the art form.
Favorite all-time show ever.
Wow.
Ever.
Wow. That would have to be a split decision between Twilight Zone and Star Trek.
For me, I would say Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Yeah. Just in terms of sheer artistry, I don't think you can do better than Twilight Zone, really. It's amazing.
I loved participating when you did the mastering of the Twilight Zone editions.
Yes.
That was fun.
Well, it was great fun. It was great fun. I produced the Twilight Zone Blu-ray, and we got to do 52 episode commentaries and have all these rarities. And some of the rarities I have in the new ebook of the Twilight Zone Companion as well. But to sit down with you and do commentary on episodes or Richard Donner or many of the people. And, you know, people like George Clayton Johnson, who was one of the great writers of Twilight Zone. He did Kick the Can and Game of Pool and Nothing in the Dark. You know, he's gone now. He died last year. And thank God I got to sit down with him and Earl Hamner, another great Twilight Zone writer who created the Waltons and Falcon Crest, to sit down with them and watch their episodes and have them talk about them. I mean, this is oral history, and thank God we're able to preserve that.
They're all going, aren't they?
Yep. Every year, fewer and fewer. But thankfully, we get to work in a medium where our work lives after us. I mean, there are shows I've written that I know people will be watching 100 years from now.
Have you ever met Kirk Douglas?
I met him once, and what was amazing, he's such a phenomenal actor, and he was really short. I was very surprised because he seems so monumental on screen. But I'm a huge fan of Kirk Douglas.
How exciting to be in your business, Mark.
Yeah.
To do what
great.
You do. And
well, you get to meet your heroes, and I love that.
Tell us the Billy Mumy story when you were a kid. This is great.
Well, you know, I was pretty much the same way when I was seven as I am now, and I was fueled by enthusiasm, and Lost in Space was on. It was one of my favorite shows, and Bill Mumy, of course, played Will Robinson, and one day I was homesick. I was in my pajamas, and I was a latchkey kid. My mom was off at work. I was raised by a divorced mom and in Los Angeles, and I got the inspiration of pulling out the phone book, the white pages, and looking up the stars of Lost in Space and calling them. Well, most of the people I called they had the same names, but they weren't the same people. But Bill Mumy's dad was listed in the phone book, and I called, and his mom picked up, and I said, "Is Billy there?" And she said, "Hold on," and Billy Mumy came to the phone. And I was so nervous, all I could do was blurt out, "Will you be my friend?" and hang up. But then I called him back, and as soon as I was over my cold, my mother drove me to his house, and he and I traded comic books, and that was the beginning of our friendship. And so, but that was me calling in my jammies.
The Japanese were big into sci-fi, especially after World War II, because almost all the influences of their films and shows dealt with radiation.
Yes.
And what it did to the environment, to animals. It made monsters.
Yes.
They were into that in a big way.
Well, you know, that's, but again, when earlier when we were talking about science fiction, you really can take the issues of the day or the fears of the day. And so there were the Japanese trying to process Hiroshima and Nagasaki and what that had meant to them and the nuclear threat in the world. And they put it into a science fiction context. They put it into a monster to process it and try and take a step back and really look at it and have a way of trying to deal with that fear. And certainly in Twilight Zone, you're dealing with modern anxieties from every direction. And now with Space Command, I'm writing about war. I'm writing about religious issues, social issues, sexual issues, you name it. And it's not, you know, but in a very constructive way. And it allows me to comment on the world. And I'm currently rewriting the third Space Command story that we'll be shooting soon. It's called The Great Solar War, and it examines issues like ISIS and what's going on in our modern world, but in a science fictional context set in the future. And so it's not ISIS, but it's dealing with those issues of fanaticism and extremism and how you find peace and how you find ways to create peace and not just have endless war. And so I'm processing that and writing about that now.
What's so amazing too, Mark, is in the old days, most of the stars of the day, let's say the comedians for television, they were all older guys.
Yes.
That would not happen today.
I know.
The Jack Bennies and the Bob Hopes and the Bing Crosbys, those guys wouldn't make it today because everything is young demos. You know, what's 18 to 49? That's what we want. They wouldn't make it, would they?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, back then, of course, they had vaudeville and guys like Jack Benny and many of those great comedians, they were trained on a very different circuit. They spent years honing their act.
Yeah. Then now, they went to radio.
Yes. And now, of course, it's just people getting, you know, going on YouTube or on the web or on Facebook and putting out something instantaneously. So it's a very different way of creating media and creating entertainment. But again, the great part is that you can find anyone easily and you can watch anything. You know, I've been watching silent films. You just call stuff up on the internet, you know, stuff that's 100 years old. So I think the great part is that young people can find these things. And I think if they have curiosity, they can look at things that from older artists and older generations. And I think that's a good thing.
The internet, has it changed things dramatically?
Hugely, yes. In the bad part, of course, is that it's instantaneous. People have short attention spans. People are distracted. They walk down the street looking at their phones. But the good part is you can reach out across the world. It gives you it's like, you know, when we watch Star Trek with a tricorder, it's like having your own tricorder where you can say, well, what's an aardvark look like? And you can type aardvark in Google, and there it is. You know, so you and I love the fact that thanks to things like Skype and so forth, I can literally talk to. For instance, the fact that I'm working with a visual effect artist in Germany, the fact that I'm doing two features in England with two producers in the UK, and that we had a Skype meeting with our fellow producers yesterday in England, and this would not have been possible without computers. I love the new technology.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take your phone calls and. You can ask Mark a question about sci-fi movies or just chime in with what you've been hearing right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and do follow us on Twitter, like so many people do, to get some of the latest information on just what the heck is going on.